Afternoon to combine a brief experience that I had in West Virginia recently. The previous Sabbath I had been asked to visit the brethren who were having a 15th anniversary celebration in Charleston, West Virginia, also the brethren at Parkersburg, bordering on Ohio. And I would like to tell a little bit about that trip and the story of the Churches of God there, and to go back also to the founding of the Churches of God in the United States, then not, of course, the United States, but one of the British colonies, and how it is that this land became the center of the freedom of religion, both on a worldwide viewpoint and also in terms of our own experience. And that, of course, in keeping with some of the things that were mentioned yesterday evening at the Bible study, this is an appropriate time to reflect, in my judgment, on why the work of God is fundamentally rooted in North America, and most singularly at the present time, still in the United States. Canada is making, of course, a major financial contribution. But indeed, the impact of the church is felt from this land. Why is it? A question that we should ask ourselves. There are very few countries that are free in this world. But before I go to that part of the story, for an occasion as this weekend is, I would like to mention briefly that West Virginia is a remarkable land within the United States historically, both from the point of view of the Churches of God and, of course, the present state of affairs. It is a very wealthy state when it comes to the minerals. It is also one of the few states that has been permanently raped since the great industrialists acquired so much of their power. Now, you see, it is an area that has immense natural resources. It's a hilly land, and people who understood that acquired the land years ago, and in a sense, most of the decisions that are made in terms of who has a job, who does not, which plant is closed, which is not, would be made in the boardrooms of other states, primarily in the Middle Atlantic or New England states. It is a significant factor, therefore, that it is easy to see one side of the story of West Virginia. But I'd like to tell a little bit, as someone who had never been there before, this state has a grave number of deficiencies because of its long-standing problem. But one of the new problems that has been added, of course, is the population pressure and the desire of those who do own much of the land where buildings could be built to resist any such building. So in a state with a reasonably low income, where, let us say, the average income or the median of the United States would be looked upon as being too prosperous by the majority of people in this state, you have a situation where the housing market is significantly higher than it is in upstate New York. A house that would be, let us say, $50,000 to $60,000 in upstate New York would be $75,000 to $80,000 in Charleston, the capital of West Virginia. And unless you happen to be an old-time property owner, you simply cannot now afford to buy. You must simply live as a renter in the various mine housing structures that are provided. It is one of those peculiar things that there are many, many poor people and also a significant number who have had roots long enough to be relatively prosperous in terms, at least, of their homes. There's no way to view the state wholly in the eyes of some of the articles that have appeared in Time magazine, at least around 1960. Where we thought of the state as a grand Appalachia, there's much of it that is not. The Southwest is. Large numbers of blacks are in the Southwest. Very few of them are members of the church. In fact, this area has the smallest accumulation of black members that I have seen in a long time, because the blacks have simply not wanted to come to this area except as they've been brought to the mine regions, where perhaps their poverty is typical of the inner ghettos of the major cities, where the number of blacks called to the Church of God is comparatively minimal in comparison with the suburbs. But they are some very remarkable brethren there, and that's quite a contrast to New York City, you know, where we have so many black members. These people are mostly English and Scotch-Irish or Ulster Scots, and they do not have the same opportunities that we generally find elsewhere. They are a people who have tended to want to be separate from the mainstream, or they wouldn't have lived there that long. As a whole, they are a people who do not immediately make your acquaintance, but when they are convinced of you and persuaded, then they are extremely warm and hospitable. There was really only one person who, other than the black brethren, only one person who spoke at any length to me for the hour before the services when I was there. They simply greeted me and walked on. They are, in that sense, by nature, essentially careful of, or even suspicious of, outsiders. The history of the state is certainly representative of the need. But after services, and apart from the question of the sermon, which, of course, could bring up questions, I found them an entirely different people. They were persuaded. They understood. And when they understand a person and are persuaded, then they have no further doubts and they are very open. I think this is a very interesting way to look at these people, quite different from my experience with the churches in the South or in Minnesota or Wisconsin. But it is indeed an interesting area. They did bestow on me, through one of the local ministers or his wife, however that was arranged, a pullover shirt that said WVU, West Virginia University Mountaineers. And I was asked to wear it, and they would like to have had proof that I would do so. So Mr. Dexter Faulkner, who is managing editor of The Plain Truth, did take a photograph of me in Randy Cole's office, where the layouts and the graphics are designed for The Plain Truth, and developed them that same day, and I gave him credit for these remarkable pictures. Was unusual the way it came out, because not everybody seems appropriately garbed in a pullover or T-shirt. But it came out very well, and I sent one to each of the ministers for the two congregations at Charleston and Parkersburg. And I should assume that my name is held in significant respect among the hill folk in the Church of God as a result. I would extend their very best wishes to you. Their history is recent in comparison with Southern California, but they are loyal. They are not gossips. They're very careful about their responsibility. And it's one of those churches that happily has wondered why everyone else flew over and went to New York and Pennsylvania or Washington, D.C. or Massachusetts, but no one ever dropped down to visit these people in West Virginia. And now there is a reason. The reason being, of course, secondarily, that not everybody was interested in small areas of the church, but something that might have been more important. But there's another real reason, and that's very difficult to get to West Virginia. I had to use Piedmont Airlines, that means the Foothills Airlines, and the countryside, of course, is full of hills, and the air strip at the Charleston is on top of the hill. Now, the interesting thing is that when I arrived there, I had both a schedule for departure as well as a standby. And the scheduled departure meant that it would have taken me between West Virginia and Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh and Chicago, Chicago, Los Angeles. I would have had to wait at the airports between 5 and 6 hours at two places to make connections, Pittsburgh and Chicago, because nothing really flies directly in there. As it was, just to give you an insight into what's the ticket that I had was simply worthless in terms of their getting me on the computer. It is interesting that this kind of situation can occur with this modern technology, but it does mean that the airlines has yet to come to grips with it. So that my schedule, where I was written up okay, where the travel agent in Southern California had said it is confirmed, they didn't have the least record. And the one where I was a standby, I happily was able to get on, even though at Chicago I had to wait 3 hours between flights to get to Southern California here. It is one of those unfrequented areas, and in a certain sense, therefore, unspoiled by much of the problem that has beset other areas of the church. I thought it appropriate at that occasion to discuss something of the nature of the history of the churches of God. Since this was a modern assemblage, we should not assume that the congregation there that was only 15 years old is necessarily the oldest congregation from a historic perspective of the church. Because the oldest congregation of the Churches of God Seventh Day goes back to the year 1859 under Pastor J.W. Niles, called the Wilbur Church of God, Wilbur being a geographic area. Now, it is this Church of God Seventh Day group of people that Mr. Armstrong came to have fellowship with in the state of Oregon in the end of the 1920s and the early 1930s, that ultimately, of course, did not seek to support the work that the brethren at Eugene, that Mr. Armstrong was led to raise up by the radio broadcast, did not seek to support that group, and in a sense have had no fellowship or wanted to have fellowship with this work since the late 1930s. Nevertheless, it was contact with them that is important in the history of the continuity of this church. What is further interesting is that this church in Wilbur, West Virginia, going back to 1859, is 2 years older than the founding of that organization called on the map. I wanted to get a map of this area, so our local minister there, Timothy Snyder, pulled out the map that he had, and we looked at the area where the Churches of God had a history. And as you may know, of course, that in 1931, the Churches of God Seventh Day, in a sense, divided like a tree that is dying, its branches that are dead fall in one direction and another. Their main headquarters, apart from the Oregon Conference that Mr. Armstrong has mentioned, was in Stanbury, Missouri, but they also had another that was centered in Salem, West Virginia at that time. And we should ask ourselves a little bit about why Salem, West Virginia. So now I will go back into the story just a little. In 1789, which was during the time of the founding of the Constitution of the United States. You remember this period of time after the nation's birth, not in 1776, which was its Declaration of Independence, but 1783, when in fact the treaty was signed that gave rise to the states as independent and so recognized by Europe. We lived under the Articles of Confederation, and then we had the Constitutional Convention that indeed it was a very important concept. And in 1789, while these things were occurring, the Brethren of the Churches of God in Shrewsbury, New Jersey, migrated from New Jersey, the southwest through Pennsylvania, and came to a community in one of the richer valleys of northern Virginia and founded a community there called New Salem. You've heard of Salem, Massachusetts. Well, this was New Salem, and it was in Virginia. Later on, of course, during the Civil War, you will note that West Virginia was split off from Virginia, and the community of New Salem came to be known as Salem, West Virginia. So I would say that we should take note in terms of the history of the Church of God that in 1789, brethren from New Jersey in the town of Shrewsbury moved and in fact founded New Salem, Virginia, which is now Salem, West Virginia. And from here they spread into a number of areas, and as we looked on the map, we marvel to what extent there were biblical names throughout the valley, as you might expect. There was Berea, and then we noted some other places that we have heard of in reading the history of the church at that time. We simply couldn't find any place on the map, however, named Wilbur. We looked at one map and then another. And so I told the brethren, as I was recounting the history of the churches of God in Virginia and West Virginia, therefore, as we now know the area, that we have the story preserved in the Churches of God Seventh Day by the authors, Duggar and Dodd, and Mr. Armstrong knew both of these men, of course, and they mention the Wilbur Church, which is the oldest functioning Church of God Seventh Day. That is a part of this group of people that Mr. Armstrong has written of in his contact with them earlier part of this century. But we simply didn't know where it is on the map, and I had never had the chance to be there to search. So after the sermon and the close of the service, someone walked up to me and he said, "I live within 3 miles of the Wilbur Church. The reason you will not find Wilbur on the map is that it doesn't exist. It simply is a church house going back to 1859 that is off a dirt road, that is off a paved road, that is near an intersection of two major roads. And there isn't anything else there." Now, this is really remarkable when one considers that this is typical of where the people whom God was then calling tended to live, out in the country, on the farm, and its oldest church congregation functioning to this day is not even in a town, not even with a post office. Just an area way off an intersection of highways. So the brethren there are going to obtain some photographs for me, both of the story of the Churches of God in Salem, West Virginia, as well as of the Wilbur Church. And one of the brethren also lives and takes care of, in the city or town of Berea that is on the map, of Sabbath-keeping people who go back to the Seventh-day Baptists. And our brethren take care of some of the elderly people of a remnant of the Seventh-day Baptist group. And remember, Seventh-day Baptists and Seventh-day Adventists represent, in a sense, people who moved away and no longer were in the mainstream of the Church of God Seventh-day. Or, one might put it another way, they were the main group of people, and only the small remnant stayed faithful. One could say, from the time of the founding of the Seventh-day Baptist organization at the beginning of the last century to the formal organization in the early 1860s of the Church of God Seventh-day, following the Seventh-day Adventist organization, the history of this church, as we look back at its roots, is centered fundamentally in the state then known as Virginia that we now know as West Virginia. And probably that link where we have the least evidence of a number of people or of leaders is to be found in this state. It's one of the weakest links in the whole history of the church when so few have ever left a record. We have a better record earlier and, of course, a complete record afterward. But in the first half of the last century, as the Brethren tended to be centered in this part of the Virginia Hills, we simply only know that they existed for the simple reason that Seventh-day Baptists refer to them, and we find them still there, and a significant local church in 1859 was already established before the Adventists organized. And they represent the bulk of the people who followed Ellen G. White, which the Church of God did not. Ellen G. White was viewed as a prophetess who taught that the Passover could be observed four times a year, which she had from her Methodist background. The Churches of God Seventh Day observed it on the 14th and only once a year. That was the big distinguishing factor early in the history of the church, and where it did not follow the Seventh-day Adventist thought that was already developing from Ellen G. White's ideas. But we go back a little further, how the church came to New Jersey, how the church came to all of the colonies on the East Coast. We would have to go back a little further in time, and here we'll pick up the story of 1664, when Stephen Mumford from the Mill Yard Church in England, that is now nearly the heart of London, came to the colony, Newport, in Rhode Island, and there explained some things about the Sabbath, the millennium, and various subjects, certainly baptism, two brethren, most of whom were Baptists there. And in 1671, on the 23rd of December, there was organized the first congregation of the Churches of God, or Sabbatarians. They would be a part of the history of Seventh-day Baptists, too, because the Baptists take their root from this, those that are Seventh-day Baptists, from 1664 to 1671, in about 7 years' time. A congregation was raised up in Newport, Rhode Island, and from that time to 1789, the churches spread throughout Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and down the East Coast. They did not continue to exist down the East Coast into the southern states, but then they began to migrate to western part of Virginia. Now I would like to ask on this day, how is it that the church should have taken root in Rhode Island? I think this is an important question for us to have some better knowledge on than we have. Why Rhode Island? Why not Plymouth Rock in Massachusetts? Why not in New York City? Why not in Charleston in the Carolinas? Why not among the followers of William Penn in Pennsylvania? And here we come to a very important story that I would like us at this 4th of July season to take note of. First of all, the United States, in its constitutional form, we think of today as a nation that has a separation of church and state. But when the early colonies in the area of New England and the Middle Atlantic states were founded, it was not a matter of separation of church and state, but a matter of religious freedom. Now we should take note that the man who founded Rhode Island as a colony, we may have learned of, but perhaps have never seen fully or clearly in the story. Roger Williams was the founder of Rhode Island. He was born in 1603. He died in 1683 at the age of 80. He was a man who was highly educated in England, but found for reasons of conscience that he simply was not prepared to serve the Church of England directly. And he came to study various subjects in the Bible as other people were studying them. Many of these subjects involved the question of taking of oaths in civic affairs, as in the court situation, the question of the government of the church, the question of baptism, the question of where the church had been, the question of the millennium, what had the church been doing for 1,260 years. All of these things were troubling many people in England at this time. This, of course, is the period that we associate with the translation of the version of the Bible that I have here, the King James Version. This is the time after the death of King James the First that Charles the First succeeded him. And there was, of course, a major controversy that was developing between the then established Church of England on the one hand and essentially the parliamentarians on the other, who were seeking to prevent Charles the First of England from going back on some of the steps that had already been taken in the Reformation in England. And the controversy blew up into a civil war. This is not a history subject at this point, but we'll take one perspective of it only. It blew up into a civil war. And we had a controversy in the 1840s between Parliament and the King. It ended, of course, with the capture of the King in 1848 and his execution in 1849 by what was then called the Rump Parliament. And this is a very significant history because it would not have been possible for Stephen Mumford to have come to Rhode Island in 1664 if there had not been a place in the colonies that had a certain concept of freedom of religion at the level that we now think of it as separation of church and state. You see, when Massachusetts was founded by the Pilgrims or Puritans, and Massachusetts Bay Colony around 1630 was established, the leaders of the colony, Puritans, did not assume that freedom of religion meant other than the state should determine what the true religion is and establish that faith. Now let me state this clearly so we know the difference between the reasons for the founding of many of the religious colonies and the nature of the state that we now call the United States. The Puritans as a whole conceived that the king needed guidance and that it was his duty to establish the true faith. It was not a question of freedom of religion, but of determining the nature of what the true faith should be. It having already been determined that the Catholic Church was not the proper continuity of the true faith by the Puritans, they viewed it as essential for Parliament to impose on the king the responsibility to properly evaluate these matters and ultimately to establish the true faith and to enforce it. It was first conceived of as a responsibility through the Church of England. But gradually different groups began to divide on the subject. The king wanted to go in the direction of the Catholic Church more and more. He was, of course, at this time a Protestant, but there was a movement in that direction in the royal family. Parliamentarians as a whole wanted the true faith to be established. They had not yet defined it because there were all sorts of arguments as to what it should be. There were those who separated and proposed to establish, shall we say, local opportunities for the Commonwealth of Israel in the New World, but essentially with the idea of establishing the true faith and enforcing it. It was in the early 1630s, after the founding of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, that we have the man of our story, Roger Williams, who came to this colony. And he thought that since these were Puritans, he should find among them a people who were dedicated, who were, through the Spirit of God, seeking to do his will, because this is what he had heard that Puritans were seeking to do. Imbued with the Spirit of God, coming to understand what the Bible says, piece by piece.